Hey there. This podcast is brought to you from aboutmeditation.com. Check out our free How to Meditate mini course, 5 easy lessons that teach you how to meditate in minutes. www.aboutmeditation.com. Welcome to the One Mind podcast from aboutmeditation.com. My name's Morgan Dix, and I'm your host. On One Mind, we explore different angles on meditation, mindfulness, and health. We interview experts and everyday practitioners to bring you the stories, the science, and the exploration that will help you understand why this ancient practice is more relevant and important today than ever before. Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 3 of the One Mind podcast. Today, I'm excited to share my interview with meditation teacher Peter Banton. But first, if you like what you hear on the show today, please head on over to iTunes and leave us a rating and review after you listen. That'll help us reach a lot more people. Okay, we've got a super interesting show for you today. If you've listened to the show before, you know that we profile a range of people on this show. We've interviewed a sports psychology consultant, an artist and businessman, and then today, we move in a more spiritual direction. Peter Banton got his first real baptism in meditation almost 30 years ago in a monastery deep in the forests of Thailand on his first extended silent retreat. And then he was hooked. After years of practicing Buddhist meditation and attending long silent retreats, Pete was on track to becoming a monk. But then his life took some unexpected turns. In this interview, we track Pete's story and discuss his current work teaching meditation at his modern-day meditation ashram in Portugal. Pete's a wonderful teacher with tons of experience. If you've ever wondered what happens on a meditation retreat, or if you're interested in going on a retreat, I think you'll find this interview very interesting. If you currently live in Europe or the UK, and you're interested in attending a meditation retreat, this interview might just convince you to join Pete in Portugal for one of his retreats. This is not a promotion. Instead, Pete's contagious passion for meditation made me feel like I wanted to go back on retreat. So enough from me, let's start the interview. So Pete, hey, welcome to the show.
Hey Morgan, it's great to be with you. Looking forward to this.
Great, me too. Why don't we just jump right in? So you've been teaching meditation for a few years, at least now.
Yeah.
And you also created something called the Awaken Life Project, which is based in Portugal. Tell everyone a little bit about who you are, what you do, what the Awaken Life Project is. Just maybe let's start, share your story a little bit.
Okay, well, I'll try and be as brief as I can. I've been captivated and fascinated by the big questions of life for as long as I can remember. So from a very young age, if I look back now, I can see that I was on some kind of a spiritual path. That's taken me through all over the world and through various experiences and adventures. Mm-hmm. At one point, for example, almost becoming a Buddhist monk in my late 20s, to then being involved in a very intensive experiment in evolutionary enlightenment, a communal experiment that you also know about.
Yes.
And more recently, out here in Portugal, co-creating with my wife, Cynthia, what we've come to call the Awaken Life Project. To fast forward to that segment, which is obviously the most relevant to our conversation, the Awaken Life Project has really come out of a convergence of all my deepest interests and passions. I think, you know, it was about 10 years ago, I found myself back in Europe. I felt, you know, coming into my mature years, you could say that now was the time, given how much I had learned.
Yeah.
Over previous years. Well, now is the time to really bring it all together and find a way to give back. Yeah, make a real contribution to the unfolding of the human spirit. The Awaken Life Project is really a multi-dimensional evolutionary education hub. It's kind of a summary I could call.
Nice, I like that a lot.
Our mission statement is dedicated to the evolution of consciousness and culture in harmony with the ecological web of life. We came here to Portugal initially because it was a place we could afford to buy some land, and we're here in a beautiful mountain valley. A really gorgeous, secluded space here with trails and waterfalls nearby.
I've seen pictures. And, it's everyone. It's a bit of a Shangri-La. Where
it is. It definitely is. It's a bit of heaven on earth. It's got echoes of Tibet because all the buildings are perched on the side of a mountain.
Mm-hmm. So Pete, just to set the scene a little bit, like, did you build all the buildings? Were there places for you to live already, or did you just start from scratch?
No, we started from scratch. We bought ourselves a Mongolian yurt, which is still here, which visitors and people who come on private retreat, they can rent a yurt here for that. But that's where we started. We lived in a yurt. We've developed into quite a buzzing little organism here, which has a few different dimensions, which I'll just touch on briefly. One is the dimension of a spiritual ashram. There's about 8 or 9 of us who live here. That's the resident community at the moment. And we're living, we're all committed to meditation practice. We all meditate every morning. We're all committed to keeping ourselves healthy. And we're endeavoring to live the truth of unity, consciousness beyond the ego, together. So far, pretty successfully, but there's always ups and downs. So that's the kind of hub. And then by this time, we have a wider community network of mostly Portuguese people.
I would be interested, Pete, when you say mostly successful, what would be the criteria you use to define that? And I know you probably don't have set ones, but like qualitatively, what would you say when you say relatively successful? What does that mean?
Good question. Well, I would say bright, happy, inspired, creative individuals thriving together.
Yes.
And so we really put a lot of emphasis on everybody's individual creative flowering and unfolding. Mm. And we also have a number of people who've been associated with us now have also started their own projects in other places with their own kind of flavor, their own emphasis, and yet they're all under the umbrella of the Awaken Life Project.
You said that you meditate together in the mornings. How long do you meditate, and is that what you start your day with?
Yeah, that's the first thing we do after waking up. We all meditate together at 7 in the morning for an hour. Mm-hmm. And then we have a period of another hour before breakfast, which is sometimes we have yoga classes. I teach Qigong also. And then we usually have a meditation session in the evening as well before dinner around 6. That's not all through the year, but in the busier months, in the spring, summer, we definitely do. In that way, the meditation practice is really the foundation of our lives together.
I wanted to just ask you a little bit more about your background. How long have you been meditating? And also, what styles of meditation have you practiced in the past? What are you practicing now, and what do you teach?
So I've been meditating for about 30 years now. I actually realized just as I was thinking about preparing for this call.
That's some hours, man.
That's some hours, yeah.
You definitely got over the 10,000. You're probably up by like 20,000 hours or something.
Yeah, I haven't worked out the hours yet. But in that time, I've done a lot of long retreats as well. So yeah, it's about 30 years. I just hit half a century. I really started to meditate.
Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. Feels like I'm just getting started.
Nice.
But I really started to experiment with meditation, when I was in my about 20 late years in university. And how I began was, well, first of all, it was through books. I remember the Alan Watts' The Wisdom of Insecurity had a huge impact on me. That was a book that really opened me up to Eastern philosophy, I suppose. So my first kind of meditation I really started to practice in earnest was through Buddhism. Basically, I ended up as soon as I quit university, traveling around the world for a few years, doing different jobs and having different adventures. And when I got to the East, when I got to Thailand, when I was about 23, 24, I really wanted to do a long retreat. And so that was the place I did my first 10-day retreat. And it was in a forest, in a forest monastery in Thailand. The meditation I was taught there was mindfulness of breathing, which is also known as anapanasati in the Pali. That's the Pali name for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so very simple, following the breath, you know, and just every time the mind would wander, you know, just coming back to the breathing. Towards the end of this retreat, I had a very, very profound awakening to non-duality, to the truth of non-duality. That was really the first realization I had about, oh my God, you know, there is only one and I am that. And I was in the forest at the time and experienced this overwhelming sense of identity with everything that surrounded me. And it was tremendously inspiring. There was something forged, if you like, in my soul at that point that changed the course of my life. Basically, from that point on, I became a Buddhist. I considered myself a Buddhist, and the Buddha's teaching just resonated very deeply with me. And I began to do regular Buddhist meditation.
Was that something you were consciously seeking, that kind of experience? Was that a goal for you when you went on this retreat, or did you have any sense what was going to happen, or did you just go on retreat?
Well, I was definitely completely captivated by the mystery of whatever enlightenment was, whatever that meant, you know, whatever the absolute truth was. Yeah, that was definitely something I was interested in. And, mm-hmm. But I didn't really have any ideas about it. What it was, and as often is the case with people, when people start out on their spiritual journey, because we're just such innocents then, you know, you're just kind of wide open and you're opening up to, you know, uncharted seas of exploration. That's often when many people have very deep revelations coming from left field, because they don't have a particular trajectory or certain ideas about what's going to happen or what should happen. It definitely was a surprise in a certain sense. But at the same time, I can see I was primed for it because I was really serious.
Before you move on, can you just say a little bit for everyone, what is non-duality in your understanding? How would you define that?
Yeah, okay. I'll just say something very briefly, and then I could say a bit more when we get to what I'm teaching now, because that's really the foundation of it. So what I mean by non-duality, which obviously means not two, is the recognition that there is only one. There is no separate, historical, isolated, skin-encapsulated ego, as Alan Watts famously called it. I love that phrase. Mm-hmm. In other words, our usual experience of ourselves is that I'm in here. You know, who I am is kind of somehow in this body, in this sort of psychological world of thought, feeling, emotion, and everything that's out there, meaning others, you know, and the world of objects, apparent objects, is not me. The recognition, and sometimes it can be from the whole spectrum of a quite overwhelming spiritual experience, let's say, accompanied usually by extraordinary bliss and maybe even ecstasy, to a very quiet and tacit just seeing of what is. So I'm very careful when I'm teaching or talking about non-duality to emphasize that it's not a particular experience. There may be experiential elements that come along with it, but in essence, it's a knowing, it's a seeing, it's a liberating understanding in which we recognize that who we ultimately are is one with all that is. And at the same time, I'm over here, I'm sitting here on this chair in the mountains of Portugal, and you're over there in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
We inhabit, you know, an individual, you could say, psychological self. But when we have those recognitions, insights, and I'm a great believer that meditation, as far as I know, is the most direct vehicle to this kind of knowing and understanding, you know, it can change in either subtle or dramatic ways how we actually see ourselves see the world, see the whole drama of life. So in essence, it's really the fundamental insight that's at the core of all spiritual traditions and all religions, of course. Yeah.
That's great. That's very helpful. I think everyone's going to find that definition helpful. Also, I really appreciate you putting the emphasis on this more being a shift in vantage point or perspective or seeing than any given experience, whether
Absolutely.
It's bliss, ecstasy, total disillusion.
Yeah, and it's also a big passion of mine is to demystify what non-duality is and find a way to communicate it and teach it from my own experience as far as I've gone into all this, but also in a way that's free from cultural baggage and also particularly Eastern concepts, as helpful as they can be. It tends to make whatever spiritual awakening is a kind of some exotic superhuman sort of attainment.
So why don't you take us back? We were with Pete in Thailand.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so in Thailand, you know, that was my first baptism into the non-dual kind of seeing, understanding I was just speaking about. And then I began to pursue Buddhist meditation in earnest. And I also began to do Vipassana. And basically, the Buddha taught two forms of meditation. One was what he called Samatha, which was concentration meditation, which mindfulness of breathing is an example of. You're focusing on an object, in this case your breathing, which, you know, is there all the time. It's always with us, so it's I think it's the most accessible object to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
And then he taught what's called Vipassana, which the original meaning of that word is insight. And so I also began to do insight Vipassana meditation retreats in the context of Buddhist practice. It was in the context of what's called the Theravada Buddhist tradition, which is the original, most essential teaching of Buddhism. So I began to do long retreats, and there was probably a period in my late 20s where I was doing quite a few of these every year. And I would always find them extraordinarily inspiring and, you know, have different kinds of insights and openings. By this time, I'd come back from my travels. I had settled in Spain. I was living in a little studio, meditating on my rooftop or in the mountains, teaching English when I had to, and playing in a blues band, which I got together. But after a while, my passion for liberation, to rediscover, give my life really to whatever that mystery was that I felt was calling me, just overwhelmed me at a certain point. And I realized I just had to give it all up. At that time, I actually felt that the only thing that made sense for me to do in my life at that point was to become a monk. So that's what I did. I moved on. And I ended up going back to the UK, and there was a number of monasteries there connected with the Theravada Buddhist tradition. Some of your listeners might be familiar with a place called Amaravati, which is quite a well-known Buddhist meditation center just north of London. I went there and to a number of other places, and I basically spent a year on going from one retreat to another. And during that time, I was convinced, this is it, I'm going to become a monk. I was ready to give up, let go of everything. I already had, really. And I continued to be deeply inspired by the retreats I did. But it was when I actually began to live in the Buddhist monasteries, I began to have some doubts. And I won't go into all the reasons why that was, but I basically began to feel intuitively that whatever I had glimpsed in my deepest experiences and understandings, and whatever the mystery of awakening really was, that somehow it wasn't being lived, you know, in these monastic settings. I felt there was something much bigger that was possible, but I didn't know what it was. And this led to a very deep spiritual crisis, because I gradually realized, oh my God, I'm not going to become a monk. Oh my God, I'd left everything, you know, I didn't have any money. I had no desire to do anything else. I was like, what am I going to do now? Basically, quite a few synchronistic events at that point led to me meeting my last teacher. And so what I began to realize in myself was that the potential for radical awakening to the mystery of non-duality is always present. It's actually screaming. It's always here. It's always now. And so from that point on, I was meditating in that context. I wasn't meditating to become free, to get somewhere, but to actually realize and deepen my grounding in the always recognition that in the deepest place I am already free.
Take us in a little bit. What describe that practice?
Technically, yeah. Okay. It's very much the essence of what I'm teaching now. Although, as I'll share, I've actually incorporated it. Everything I've shared with you in terms of my own trajectory into how I'm teaching meditation now. But in terms of this, what we could call pure consciousness meditation or formless meditation, so this is meditation without any kind of object, without any kind of trying to do anything. Even in Vipassana, what's popularly practiced as Vipassana, you still usually have the subtle or not so subtle sense of being the witness of your experience. So there's somebody in there still doing something. You know, I am observing, watching sensations, phenomena come, arise and cease. There's still a subtle sense of someone doing a practice to get somewhere. The radical shift I'm talking about is where you, when you sit down to meditate, you're already in posture of complete let go, in the sense of you're not trying to get anywhere, you're not trying to achieve anything, you're not trying to control or manipulate your experience in any way. You're simply at ease with what is. That could be the whole spectrum, from deep resounding silence and maybe even bliss on one hand, to your mind and emotions going crazy like a monkey with its head cut off on the other. The idea in this pure consciousness meditation is you, whoever you are, have no preference. You do not move. You just allow whatever is to be as it is. You do not desire anything in particular. In other words, you're not trying to hold on to any kind of positive experience. And you're not trying to fear, you're not fearing or pushing away anything that's challenging to bear. You're just simply with what is. You can't get any more simple than this. Of course, the mind, you know, that wants to be busy doing something often has all kinds of problems with it. But again, you just let that be as it is. All the movements of the mind that are trying to get somewhere or insist that I'm not doing it, insist there's some kind of problem, you just let that be as it is. It's a posture of radical acceptance of everything as it is, your whole experience. Mm-hmm. And in that, if one does that with a genuine passion, it can open up very deep insight and perspective. If we're actually interested and compelled by the deep existential question, you know, who am I really? Am I my mind? Am I my emotions? Am I this historical entity that was born at a certain time? Or is that just part of who I am? Am I something much bigger than that?
I know from my own experience, insight and self-understanding have been some of the biggest fruits from that practice.
Absolutely.
And gaining penetrating clarity around really oneself, that I don't know how else you would achieve it. In a certain way, it's like a lightning bolt illuminates a landscape, which is yourself. And you suddenly see, you know, you can sometimes see yourself in relief in ways it's hard to imagine. And I'm sure there's other ways, but it's hard to imagine getting that kind of maybe objective perspective on yourself.
Yes. And I think, as I was saying earlier, we can basically boil meditation practice down to two types of meditation. Either it's meditation on an object, whether it's the breathing or a mantra or some kind of visualization practice. And then you have meditation without an object, or formless meditation, or pure consciousness meditation, as I call it, where there is no particular object of focus or concentration, and one's rather letting the attention just open without limit. And I think both practices have their place. And it's interesting that in the traditions, generally, they would start practitioners out with the concentration meditation on an object practice. than when enough stability or presence of mind has been cultivated, then they would, the teacher or the tradition would recommend that one would drop the object. So there's more of a direct discovery of one's true nature. Meditation on an object, as I experienced on that retreat in Thailand, can lead to very profound spiritual experiences of all kinds, you know, often quite energetic experiences, but also deep seeing of non-dual truth. I think experiencing those deeper states is important because it's in those deeper states we actually see before our very, the eye of our consciousness, wow, well, there's no thought here and I'm still here. There's a very real recognition, well, who I am is beyond thought and feeling because that's all quietened down and here I am, whoever I am, in this wide open, liberated space.
Take us a little bit into, you referred to the way you're working with people now really integrates all your practices. Let's transition a little bit. Tell us a little bit about that, this sort of integrated approach, and how you work with people. What are some of the common questions you get from people, in particular, who are new to meditation? Yeah. How do you work with them? How do you respond?
Okay, good. Of course, I was teaching this very direct, pure consciousness meditation that I've just been speaking about. And yeah, it definitely had big impact on people from the beginning. But one thing I began to notice over time was that, especially in the context of only a weekend retreat, it was too much of a jump for most people.
Right.
You know, to go from zero to letting go of my mind and emotions and not having any preference whatsoever. So what I began to do is, in the weekend retreats, we start Saturday morning, I'll usually spend the first two or three sessions in the morning teaching mindfulness of breathing and helping to get people just grounded in their body, in the present moment, and just every time the mind wanders, just coming back. And also actually experiencing the beauty, actually, of just being aware of the body breathing. It's very underrated.
Ha, yeah, I've never heard
of it. Yeah, it's because it is life itself. It's the pulsation of life itself. And there's something about appreciating that, really. Being with it and staying with it, that I am trying to awaken people to. So in the 1 week retreats, I'll spend the first day just on mindfulness of breathing. And depending on how it's going, maybe a little more, maybe a little less, just depending on how it's going. What I find that does is it gives people a grounding. It brings them, as I said, into the body, into the retreat kind of setting and environment. And it gives them an anchor. So then from there, I'll introduce the pure consciousness meditation, which I'll share with you just in a minute. But what I do, you see, is I say, if ever you're really struggling, you can always go back to this anchor of the mindfulness of the breathing. So in that way, I give people a choice. If they are really struggling to just let everything be as it is, they can always go back to that. That seems to work very well because obviously some people will they'll be able to let go of that and they just want to go straight into the no object kind of open awareness meditation. But for some people, especially beginners, it's been very helpful for them to have that backup, if you like.
Yeah, totally.
Because then they don't end up getting impatient and frustrated. And of course, if one does do the mindfulness of breathing with real commitment and sincerity, it's a very powerful practice in itself. So that's basically how I've integrated the two. But I'm very passionate about that meditation is taught, or I teach it in a context of engagement with the world and the life process. I still feel too many people, as I did, you know, I actually see that while there was also a pure selfless motivation, I also wanted to escape. You know, a lot of people are attracted to spiritual practices to somehow escape from the complexity of life and find some inner equilibrium that will be undisturbed. I'm very passionate about teaching meditation as a practice that is a foundation to live an awakened life, you know, and that's why we call our project the Awakened Life Project, and not as an end in itself, not as a vehicle just for inner transcendence. That's pretty much how I'm teaching my retreats. And
that's great. It's very clear.
And then just to say a little bit about what you asked about the questions, of course, the main question I always get in one shape, one form or another, you know, inevitably in the first 2 or 3 days, is how do I make my mind stop? It's some version of that. It's some version of what's happening with my mind is a problem or shouldn't be happening. This is the most common obstacle, as far as I can tell, for people who begin meditation, and even for people who've been practicing it for years, still struggle with this.
It's by far the most common question that we get at About Meditation too.
Yeah, and then the way I always answered it, I've answered it already really, and what I've said is that the ultimate goal of meditation is not to silence your mind. It's to realize a depth and understanding from which to engage with your mind. You know, in other words, to realize that, you know, the mind is not who you are. Who you really are is consciousness, for want of a better word. We have to call it something. It's awareness, it's consciousness, is that which is aware of thought. But that's the purpose of meditation. So if you're somehow trying or wanting your experience to change or to stop, you'll be endlessly frustrated. And as I've said, the paradox is when people really accept it and let it in, and sometimes, you know, it takes a while. But if people do, and I usually find in the context of a one-week retreat, by about day 4, something happens in the room, in the collective as a whole, and people start being meditated. It starts to become more effortless as people stop struggling with their experience. And it's then, you know, the insight and the understanding starts to cascade in. Oh my God, now I get it. It doesn't actually matter what my mind is doing. It doesn't matter. I realize I'm free from it. I'm experiencing this peace, joy, freedom that isn't attached to any particular state of peace, joy, freedom. And of course, this is something one can't really understand until one has really experienced it. It's like trying to describe to someone what a cup of tea tastes like, you know. I haven't tasted it.
It's perfect for an English person to say that, yes.
So,
nice. All right, so we're getting towards wrapping up, but I have a couple more questions that I want to ask you. Can you briefly give us a sense, like literally give us the schedule? What does a day on retreat look like? What would any given day, how do you structure it?
Yeah, sure. So we usually start on a Friday evening, in the evening. So we begin with dinner, communal dinner, and then an orientation session in the evening. And then we go into silence after that. So the silence begins on the Saturday evening, and I lay out the rules for the silence, which are pretty obvious. You know, no talking, no whispering, no reading, no music. Mm-hmm. And the schedule is usually we start with a 6 a.m. meditation. Meditation sessions are generally 45 minutes with a 15-minute break in between. On the 1 week retreats, we will do 6 till 8 or 6 till 7 meditation. And then there's a Qigong session before breakfast. I really enjoy incorporating the Qigong. It's something I just started doing over the last couple of years because it really grounds people. You know, it gives people a chance to move their body, you know, in a very meditative fashion. I've also come to appreciate how what the Chinese call qi and the Indians call prana, you know, is the subtle energy, we could say, that emanates from pure consciousness. It's kind of, you could say, an in-between ground or phenomenon between the formless and form. So working with the Qigong and meditative movement, many people have found to be a great complement to these retreats. Then after breakfast, we'll do 3 sessions of meditation, one after another, until lunchtime. And the lunch break will usually be a couple of hours. And we're in beautiful surroundings here, so I encourage people to be in nature, go for a walk, etc. And in the afternoon, we'll come back and do some more sessions until tea break. Got to have a tea break, being a Brit.
Definitely.
Tea break about 5:30 for half an hour. Then back in usually for one or two more sessions before dinner. And the other thing I forgot to mention is on the 1 week retreats in the afternoon, I give everybody one of these non-duality contemplations. The contemplations actually break open one's habitual perception and way of looking at things. And I've written them in such a way that they're like a practice. You know, you take people through a certain process of contemplation. So
it's not like a koan or something. It's more like a
It's more like a written something with a thread, looking Got into it. Relationship to the body, or what is the body, what is thought, emotion, nature of time. Because there's a lot of talk of the present moment in meditative and spiritual circles, and when it's referred to in that way, it kind of gives the impression that the present moment is this kind of fleeting moment that's crunched in between the past and the future. Whereas, you know, the contemplation on time, I take people into the recognition that everything is now. That there's only one moment in which our awareness of the past arises. If we think about the past, it's arising in this now moment, and in which the potential as yet unmanifest future arises. It's all arising. All time is arising in the context of this no time or this now moment. So that's just one example, you know, and that has a very profound impact on people. And then you can imagine if you go very deep into that and then you sit down to meditate, it can alter the context in which you're meditating. Maybe you suddenly realize there was some perceptual scaffolding in place that isn't there anymore. It opens up more doorways. So I'm working a lot with a combination now of meditation, fundamental grounding in meditation practice, Qigong, and these contemplations. And then, of course, in the question and answer sessions, we go deeper into the contemplations and people can ask questions related to them. They always turn out to be very dynamic collective inquiries. So that's basically a day. Usually on the longer retreat, somewhere about day five, we'll go out one afternoon and go to the beach. So we'll go for a silent walk on this amazing beach and do a silent meditation on the beach, which is by that stage of the retreat, it's just pure bliss.
Oh, I bet.
And then if we're doing the retreat here in the mountains, we'll go for a walk on one of the trails here.
Wow. It's great. It's great to hear you talk about retreat. I haven't been on retreat for about 2 years, and that obviously after being on silent retreats for probably like 12 or 13 consecutive years, it's really wonderful to hear about it, especially because it evokes the kind of unique quality and culture that emerges on retreat, the silence, the power of the silence, the living quality of that silence that you share with people on retreat, and how you really start to, it's kind of like you inhabit a different self. One of the most moving things for me has always been that participatory silence where you're all together in this powerful form of communion, and yet there's no speaking, but you're fundamentally together.
That's something I always say actually at the beginning of the retreat, when, you know, as I said at the beginning, everyone introduces themselves and shares why they've come on the retreat, and I say well we're going to go into silence now. But I always say, well, it might seem like you haven't had much time to get to know each other, but I can guarantee you by the end of this week of silence, or even a weekend, you will feel more intimately one with each other than you could possibly imagine.
Well, great. So two final questions. Can you say a little bit about, say, some of your recent influences? What's inspired you lately? Books, movies, artists?
I've gone very deeply into people like Ramana Maharshi. Sri Nisargadatta had a huge impact on me. Krishnamurti. So, you know, I've been influenced definitely by a number of great teachers, masters, to say.
Yeah.
And the Buddha, of course, is always a deep reference point for me.
What about non-meditation related, just random? Like, what are some things that inspire you outside explicitly of any of the spiritual context? Like, for instance, blues guitar.
Ah, okay. We're getting onto the blues guitar subject. As you know, I'm a musician. My primary passion in terms of guitar is blues, although it's not limited to that. But why do I love the blues? It's because it's at its best, it's pure soul. It's a kind of combination of a quite defined structure, you know, within which there can be an enormous range of self-expression. It just does something to me on a soul level. Maybe I was a black man in a past life in Alabama.
I resonate, man. I felt like I had my first musical awakening to the blues when I was in college in Atlanta. Yeah. There's a place called Fat Matt's Rib Shack, and they always had live blues, and I was hypnotically attracted to this place. It stirred something so deeply inside me.
It's interesting. Because I'll never forget the first, because I grew up listening to a lot of blues because my dad was very into it, but I never forget the impact that the kind of 12-bar blues structure had on my psyche. It was just something very primal. There's also a link there with meditation.
Definitely.
Tapping into sort of something very primal and prior. The blues to me kind of symbolizes or signifies this kind of ground that I very much equate with meditation and non-dual perception.
I think that's a perfect place to round it out with this interview. Can you tell everyone a little bit, Pete, about your soonest upcoming retreat? Where is it? When is it? How can people find out more about it and anything else about it?
Well, first of all, if any of you out there are interested to find out what the Awaken Life Project is all about and what we're offering, we have a website, awakenlifeproject.org. So there you can find out about all our events, and including the meditation retreats. If you want to find out more about my own writings and work, I have my own website, which is peterbampton.com. So that's Peter, BAMPTON.com. And that's something I'm just starting to develop with articles. And currently I'm in the process of writing a short book, and I'm posting some of my drafts from that. You'll see the next retreat advertised on the front page. It's called the Spring 1 Week Meditation and Non-Duality Retreat, which is happening in May. I think it's the 9th to the 15th of May. So that's the next one, is in May. And then I'll be doing several shorter retreats through the summer, weekend and a 4-day retreat in August. Then I'll be doing a 10-day retreat in the autumn. That'll be in November. And then I always do a New Year's retreat, a 1-week retreat over New Year, just after Christmas.
And all of that is on your
website. It's all on the website, yeah.
Okay, so I will put links to all of this to both the Peter Bampton website and the Awakened Life Project website in the show notes, so everyone, you can pick up all the information about Pete's work there. Pete, thank you so much. This has been great. I think people are going to get tremendous value out of it, and it was a delight to have you.
Great. Thank you, Morgan. It's really been a pleasure to speak about this. One thing I'd want to say to all your listeners, you know, whether you're have an established practice or whether you're just starting out, keep on keeping on. Don't give up. Just sit down, find some time every day or nearly every day to sit down and just be with yourself. And as far as I know, that's the most positive commitment any of us can make in terms of transforming not only our own life, but potentially our relationships.
Thank you, Pete.
Thank you, Morgan.
So I hope you enjoyed that interview with Peter Bampton. If you've ever wanted to go on a meditation retreat, I hope this stimulated your desire even more. And I encourage you to check out Pete's website at the Awaken Life Project. So this episode of the One Mind Podcast is brought to you by our free How to Meditate mini course. You can learn how to meditate in 5 easy lessons. Check it out at aboutmeditation.com. And if you enjoyed the show, please head on over to iTunes and leave us a rating and a review. Now, I love to end each show with an inspiring quote. Today, it's from the Indian activist and meditation teacher Vimla Thakur. She writes, "Meditation is meeting eternity in the present moment. It is resolving every problem as it comes. It is resolving every tension as it creeps in. It is facing the challenges of life in a non-fearful way.